Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. Sunday night. What should I say? I don't know what I want to say. Where do you start? When you're developing meditation, what we're doing is we're not so much trying to find a particular type of experience, but we're trying to remember the sense of being present, and we're trying to sustain the sense of presence. So one can be present within a feeling of being cold or warm. So you can be in this room and feel cold or warm. Or you can be in this room and feel, you know, pain in the hip or in the knee, or you can feel quite pleasant. Right? So the quality of the experience varies for all of us. But that's not really what's so important. What is important is to really recognize a sense of being present in the moment, and not caught up with past and future, or at least to know that past and future coming and going, to know thoughts, to know feelings. So it's the sense of presence which is essential in the practice of meditation. So what we do is we take an object of meditation like a mantra or the breath, or you know, whatever you kind of trained with or you like to use, visualization, and then we use that as a focus, as a way of remembering the present moment. Then when we come to that sense of being present, being here now, listening, knowing, then we can drop the object of meditation. People do this when you go for a walk on the beach. If you go for a walk on the beach and you look out just to the expanse of the ocean, it's a different kind of experience to watching a rugby game. Or say the Canadians are as passionate about ice hockey as Kiwis are about rugby. Both crazy games, my opinion. And Canada was in the finals of the Olympics against USA, and USA are the big rivals, and 3/4 of Canada watched this game. Right? And the watching was very passionate. Now that kind of watching has a kind of investment in it, doesn't it? It's driven by a kind of interest to see what will happen next and who will win and so on and so forth. But that kind of looking isn't meditative looking, it's passionate looking, which is fine. It's good fun and you forget about your mortgage or whatever. So that is one kind of a looking. But when we walk on a beach, at least me, and you look out to the ocean or you look at the night sky or anything like that, and you just look out at it, that spaciousness, that expanse, it's not the same. It's, for me, what it reminds me of is the sense of being present. By just walking on the beach, looking out, the whole sense of being distracted by the sense world or trying to get something out of the sense world or that kind of movement of reaction or desire or fear that washes away. And there's just a sense of being on the beach, just the color, just the expanse, the space. And you know that I think all of us have had that kind of a feeling, that sense of a presence. The same with sound. Maybe if you're listening to some kind of, maybe if you're listening to a passionate political speech, or something, and or you're getting really reactive to the speech. You know, someone's saying something really racist, and you're getting really angry. How could they say that? That's a different kind of a listening. But if you listen to the sound of the surf, or the sound of the stream, so that kind of just allowing the sound to come to you is very calming, very settling, and brings you to a sense of presence. So there's a different kind of way of using or being with sense experience. So when we train in meditation, we're trying to really bring our hearts and minds to that sense of pure presence, knowing the way things are, be they pleasant or unpleasant. If you're meditating with a desire to get some kind of an event, such as peace or some experience of bliss or whatever, then that very trying to get something will make you very frustrated, to say the least. It's a bit like the similes we have for awareness or knowing or presence. One of the ones we have is like a wheel of a cart. You've heard that one before. You have the wheel of the cart, so you have the rim of the wheel, and you have the hub, and you have the spokes. Now the distracted being is always out on the hub. So they're distracted by sounds and sights, especially emotions and ideas and thoughts. So some kind of a thought comes up in the mind, and one's attracted by that thought, and one begins to think that thought, some future plan, some past resentment. And one's on the wheel, one's spinning around. But that feeling or that thought also points to the sense of presence. Any emotion points to the sense of presence, be it fear, anger, always requires presence. It's easy to do with the sea or with the sky. You look up at the night sky and you get that awesome feeling of just space. And the sense of just being present. I think we've all tried that, even as kids. Lay down in the grass and look up the sky. But it's more difficult to do with fear and thought and desire and memory and these kinds of things, because these things are very sticky. And they pull us out into the wheel. And notice how, let's say, if you are sitting here, let's say you've planted some trees, and you hear these little guys running around, right? Doing their wind sprints up and down, possums. And you've got some trees planted out there. Well, the sound of the possums then triggers off your desire of what you want. So you hear the sound of possums, and you don't want the possums to eat your tree, so you start to think, we've got to get rid of the possums. We've got a possum problem. And the mind starts to think, and then it's on the wheel. It's just like spinning around thinking about our possum problem, and then the bell rings 45 minutes later after you've solved the possum problem. So thought. But if the sound, if you're just listening, in pure listening, and you let the sound come to you in a very receptive way, then the sound brings you to the presence, reminds you of presence. And it's in that presence, or in awareness, or in being, that you find the still peace of the heart. We say that that presence or that knowing is the gates to the deathless. It's the opening to peace and freedom. So our relation to the sense wheel changes in the meditative mode. It's not like I'm trying to get anything out of the sense world, but the sense world reminds me of that pure presence, pure sense of being, pure knowing. As Ajahn Sumedho would say, now is the knowing. In the Thai tradition, you say, in the Thai forest tradition, be the knowing. Now that knowing, you know, we were sitting here, and most of us, I think, heard the sound of the possums running up and down. Right? Now that knowing, the sound changed, and then they left, right? And then you had some thoughts, and then I rang the bell. Right? So all the events, the sense events of thoughts and sounds and sights and all, those are always changing, right? Coming and going. But that sense of presence is unchanging. But it has no quality. It's not pretty. It's not big. It's not small. Because it's not on the hub. It's not on the wheel. It's on the hub. It's the hub. It's the center. And the center has no... It's the still point. It's the still point. And the problem with sense experience is that human beings are forever trying to make the hub right, get it right, and it's always spinning them around. They're always looking in the wrong place. They're looking for a sense experience, and the Buddha says all sense experience is really tentative. It's very unsure. It'll be pleasant for a while, but then it'll change. And so we say it's not on the rim of the wheel. It's in the center where you find true peace and true liberation. It's not through the getting rid of fear, but it's through the knowing of fear where you'll find the freedom from fear. It's a very radical kind of way to look at it. And what you find then as you kind of work in your spiritual life, you'll find that part of the whole rim, that outside, is a continual commentary. You know, the little voice which is always saying you did it right, or you should have been bigger or smaller. The continual commentary on living. This criticism or trying to do something or trying to get rid of it, which is still actually part of the rim. Because all thought is on the rim. All thought you can know. And the knowing is not a thought. In spiritual language, we use listening, seeing, knowing, aware, mindful. These are synonymous terms. Listening is a very good metaphor or the language of knowing. When you listen, it brings you to a kind of sense of centeredness. When you just really listen, without any kind of a program, any kind of an agenda to try to get something or get rid of something. And the most difficult object to really reflect off of or know is desire. Because desire, what desire does, it tries to pull you out into that spinning wheel, into the outside. Yeah? It tries to get a good condition, like pain. We have bodies which experience pain. And so there's desire in the body, and that's natural. Natural to have desire, nothing wrong with it. And so we seek to get rid of the pain, so we move around, which is fine. But much of life is unpleasant. It's either painful or it's uncomfortable, and that's a given. And if one can actually, without hurting oneself, if one can actually reflect on the very feeling of unpleasantness, that the very feeling of unpleasantness is also brings you back to pure presence. It also reflects pure presence. It's like all things are mirrors. All experiences, all sights, all sounds, whatever they are, whether pleasant or unpleasant, are all mirrors to presence. It's the other way around. We tend to be always seeking some kind of experience to find fulfillment and satisfaction, which works a little bit, otherwise we wouldn't do it. But ultimately, the doors to the deathless are back here. It's very close. It's so close that it's too close. So the very feeling of fear, if you use that to say, well, what is it that knows that? Fear brings you back to presence. Whereas if you don't understand fear, say, and you just react through fear, then what we do is we create a world. We create a self and a world. So the mood of fear comes up, and rather than knowing it and being the pure presence within the movement of fear, being in the hub, the fear comes up, and what that creates is thought, and the thought creates a me and a you, and it creates a world. And the world becomes a projection of fear. Let's say someone's very paranoid, that's classic, that feeling of fear comes up and it's projected outwards and they're after me, they're trying to do something to me. Paranoia, fear, and so on. Now, when fear is known as just an object, just something on the rim, then that frees you from the fear. It's still there, it's a movement, but it also frees the world, because the world is no longer defined through my delusions of fear, or loneliness, or all these different kind of human emotions are all take you back to the pure silence of the mind, if you can bear with them. Now, to bear with unfulfilled desire is not, it's kind of almost counterintuitive. It's certainly counter-habitual, because our habit, when desire comes up, is to seek something on the rim, to seek some compensation. So when we feel bored, we seek a distraction, which is all right. I mean, it's not evil. There's nothing kind of evil about that. But the trouble is then, our fulfillment is always dependent on this movement, and we're kind of spun around with it. But if we can see that boredom itself is an object of mind, and it actually points to presence, we find the freedom from boredom. Not by getting rid of it, not by thinking, but not by analyzing it, but by realizing that it always takes us back to pure presence, or pure knowing, or being, or silence, or whatever we might call that. But what most people do with boredom is, of course, look for something interesting, exciting. Doubt is that way too. You know, when doubt arises as a condition of mind, it's a mood. It affects the way I think. It affects the way I perceive, I interpret. So doubt arises. And rather than seeing that what makes doubt possible is presence, knowing, awareness, I seek a compensation, I seek some kind of an answer. So I become intellectual. Now, I've been reflecting a lot on how very intellectual Theravada Buddhism is. How many, partially because I've been helping a bit with the library, and talking with Bobby about all these titles and books, and this incredible kind of array of ideas being pumped out. And I always have been pumped out. So there's a kind of idea that somehow, if you just get more knowledge, read more, collect more information, somehow you're going to suss it all and you'll be free. But it doesn't work that way. What you just get is more knowledge. And knowledge is not wisdom. Knowledge is not liberation. So it's also kind of different than the worldly realm, because in the worldly realm you need a lot of knowledge, don't you? Like, whatever field you're working in, there's so much. I was talking to a doctor this morning, and the amount of studying this man has done, kind of specialist and also has an MBA, and kind of, I was thinking, what do I know? So the worldly way is a kind of accumulation of information, and as our societies become more complex, we need more information, and there's this kind of collecting, getting more and more and more. But the spiritual life is much, much different. It's much more a movement towards simplicity. A kind of letting go of the dross, putting down the burden, letting go. And the ultimate simplicity is actually this very simple sense of knowing. The difficulty with that is you can't locate it, you can only be it. You cannot locate knowing. It's not in your body, it's not in your head. It just is. It's just pure presence, pure knowing. So contemplate, like when you do meditate, is there a desire to get something? Like when you sit down, right, and you set your posture up, are you there to try to get rid of something, or to become something, or to kind of get something you had before, or to figure something out? Because if you don't notice that kind of driven energy, that willfulness in the practice, then you'll always be looking for something on the rim. But if you notice the very feeling of trying to get something and accept that, then that very feeling of trying to get something brings you back to pure presence, which is not something you get, it's something you are, something you be. It's a being rather than a becoming. Once you get the hang of this, then you don't really have to meditate so much. You can look at anything. You can look at a grill. You look at the grill, and the grill reminds you of pure presence. You don't have to kind of sit there and snort your nostrils or do kind of special postures or, you know, all of that is kind of nice exercises for bringing you back to the center. But should be something where all the sense world, all emotions, all feelings and thoughts bring you back, because they're all kind of reflective mirrors of pure presence. When you look at a Buddha, try really doing that. Look at something like a Buddha. And really, just like if you look at it right now, and just let it come to you, and you get a sense of just being present. It's not the Buddha. It's not the external. It's something in you. It's pure presence. And that's why, like in meditation, we choose very kind of neutral things, like breath, to kind of get that sense of presence rolling, as it were, to remember that. Then your challenge is like to take the habits of the kind of emotional habits, the neurotic habits that we all kind of suffer from, and really begin to just be the witness of that, to see that like annoyance, if you feel annoyed at something, there's that which knows annoyance. It's like color, say. What makes this floor brown? Or honey colored, or those mats brown, or the chairs blue, is light. Right? It's light that makes the blue or the brown, and the way the light interacts that makes it possible. If we turn all the lights off, we don't see anything. It's all dark, it's black. Well, awareness is light, right? And awareness makes everything possible, or presence, or knowing makes everything possible. Without that, you couldn't know emotions, you couldn't know sights and sounds and so on. So those are the kind of things, like sights and sounds, they are merely pointing back to this, that spiritual life is the reverse. Now to do this, obviously, it takes a kind of stopping. You have to somehow stop the kind of restlessness of the mind, the endless kind of figuring out the next problem, getting to the next event. So this movement of past and future that we are so habituated to, this movement of continually rehearsing the future, or being anxious about the future, or remembering or resenting the past, this kind of shifting back and forth, that has to be seen as just thought. Just as an idea, just as an object of mind. Because as long as we are the subject of that, then we can never be we're not in the present. We're just kind of lost in past, future. Some of the kind of self-evident things of doing something so simple, it's very, very simple, it's so simple it escapes people because they're looking in the wrong place. It's so elegant. It's very elegant, actually. It's kind of really stripped down. Kind of practice. And everything else should lead to that. Morality. Why do we practice morality? Well, we practice morality because life is much better if we live a moral life. We don't practice morality out of fear. Some fear is helpful if a person is very degenerate. It's good to put a bit of fear into their lives. But a life of morality, of course, is a protection. And it makes you feel good, you don't have remorse, generosity and so on. Now so those are the basis for the practice of knowing or awareness. Now one very interesting thing is when you are willing and are willing just to abide in the knowing of the way things are, what you begin to find is that's what love is. Because love is not What isn't love is when I separate myself from others. When I create a you and a me through my judgments or my desires. Like if I want something from you, or I'm criticizing you, or I'm judging you and all that, then there's no love in the heart. It's not unitive, it's separative. But when there's the putting down of all that, when there's a putting down of desire, what you find is the heart really begins to open. It's a very loving relationship because there's no desire in it. Not love in a sentimental way, but love in a unitive way, where there isn't a sense of me and you. Because in that pure presence, the sense of ego goes. You know, when you're really listening, let's say if you're just looking at the Buddha, if you just look at that, there's no sense of self there, there's just pure looking. And then the thought might come in, I'm looking at the Buddha, or what's he talking about, or whatever. That's a thought. But just in the pure looking, there's no ego in it, there's just looking. Or it's just listening, if you just listen. It's just listening. All that ego stuff goes away. So ego is thought and desire, and it's a complexity which can be known as an object. But in the pure knowing, we find love. Love in its kind of spiritual sense, not in a sentimental way. So the way what we often try to cultivate in Buddhist practice are the ways of the heart which are unitive rather than separative. So that what is separative is anger, fear, greed. It's always separative. If I want something, I'm always separate from the object. I want to own it. Whereas if you look at compassion and empathy, those kinds of, and acceptance, those kinds of states of mind, they're not separative. Like when I really accept fear, really accept it, not as some kind of I must accept this, but I really accept it without thought, with pure knowing, that makes me aware of it, and it's not a problem. And that's what love is. It's not, I'm not pushing it away, I'm not judging, I'm not trying to get rid of it, I'm just allowing it. And in that allowing, there's the freedom from fear. Fear still comes and goes, but it's not really mine. It's just an energy that comes and goes. But when fear becomes mine, I own it, then I begin to think through it, I create a world from it, I create projections about things, and it's a fearful world. And I am enslaved, and the world is enslaved to these energies of fear. Self-disparagement, self-criticism, all these different kinds of things we experience as human beings. They are simply objects of mind that come and go. They're bubbles, they're clouds that come and they go. And that presence is where you find the spiritual center. We talk about the heart in Buddhism, or we use the heart in spiritual life. Sometimes the heart's the pumping heart, so you have the blood thing, the muscle. Sometimes the heart is the heart chakra. So all of us who have felt love or compassion, we feel it here, don't we? Or the other, fear or anger, or you know, when the heart's closed, we talk about that. The heart chakra, that's one way of talking about heart. And the third way of talking about heart is the center of something, the essence of something, the heart of the matter, we say, the heart of the matter. And the heart of the matter in Buddhism is awareness, pure presence, listening, knowing, seeing. But not just seeing with the eyes, not just hearing with the ears, not just listening with the ears, not just knowing with thought, but that What is it? What is it that makes, like, what is presence? Have you ever thought about that? Like right now, just sitting here. How do you know you're sitting here? You know you're sitting here, right? Well, what is that? You can't define it, can you? But you know you're sitting here. Or if you start to get, if my stomach's rumbling, so if you start to feel your stomach rumbling. There's something that knows your stomach. My stomach is rumbling, right? What is that? It's not the stomach, is it? It's not the sound, and it's not the taste, and it's not the bodily feeling, but what is it? What is that presence? And that's the big mystery. And that mystery is something you don't figure out with your head. If that's really what you begin, that's what your refuge is, or that's who you are, or that's what Buddha means, or whatever, you know, there's different ways we talk about that. You cannot become the knowing. You are the knowing. It's not something you become, is it? Like, if I just do this practice now, I'll get that later. No, it's just I wake up to it. I am that. You keep waking up, waking up, waking up, waking up. And you can wake up to the, you know, it doesn't really matter. Even if you have the most awful kind of thoughts, let's say you want to, you know, you want to murder all the neighbors because their dogs bark too much, fine. Just don't do it. But it's just a thought. It's just a feeling. Even that can be known. Whereas what we do with our critical faculty and our very idealistic kind of way of looking at religion is we don't see that as just a bubble. We create a self around it. I'm a terrible person. I shouldn't have, you know, hated the neighbors. And that's all on the rim. That's all on the rim. We just keep going spinning around. And so our what we think is awareness is oftentimes just criticism, commentary, blah, 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 blah stuff. You know, just, oh, no, it shouldn't be, no, 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 no. And we don't see that the very criticism is the problem. It's still on the rim. So, you know, being kind of good people, it's better than not having a kind of critical faculty. But still, it's still the same problem. If I feel annoyed at you, and then I start to think I shouldn't be annoyed, it's still the same vicious circle. But just knowing that the feeling of annoyance is known, and there's a presence which knows that, and not make a problem out of it. Obviously not pursue it, but not repress it. Not make a problem out of it. Then there is pure knowing. And so the very feeling of annoyance takes you to peace. That's the irony of it. Whereas the critical, desire, idealized mind is always trying to find some kind of perfection in all this. Me is a nice guy who, you know, never feels annoyed at Hasapanya and always loves Steve and is always grateful and, you know, I always sit up and get up at 4 o'clock in the morning, which never happens. Sometimes I like this guy and sometimes I don't and sometimes I'm in this. But that's just the way the mind is. It just comes and it goes. And if I take identity with any of that, then I'm on the hub. And what, of course, you find is then the feelings of separation and alienation, which come up as annoyance or greed or whatever, because then there's no investment in them, either through repression or belief or, you know, either way, they have no power. They're just soap bubbles. They just go away. And the heart really begins to kind of function from a whole different place. It begins to function from spontaneity, from purity, from silence. And that spontaneity is always available. You know, it's always available to respond in a way which is not just a function of old habits. You know how sometimes we can just kind of always react to the same habitual ways, just kind of Pavlovian old reactions, right? And just kind of then hate ourselves for those reactions. But as we watch that reactive mind, reactive habits, and we just know them, we sense there is this silent possibility of responding according to each moment, because each moment has its own wisdom. Each moment has its own necessity. You know, like a solution arises with a problem, doesn't it? They're one and the same thing. They're together. So my response to the world arises with the world. It's not something separate from it. Where the problem is when I separate myself from it with fear and desire and all those judgments, then my responses are really just kind of historical bad habits. And I always have a residue if I do that. You know, when I'm just kind of reacting through grumpiness or all these kinds of things and I'm not aware of it, and or I hate myself for it or whatever, I always get a residue of regret or remorse. And whereas in the spontaneous heart, which comes from silence and knowing, there's no residue. There's no memory traces. It's just appropriate to time and place. So pure presence implies acceptance. But acceptance does not imply condolence. Like if I accept the feeling of annoyance I might feel for one of my fellow monastics, I accept that, but I don't follow it. I don't dump it on people, because that would be attachment, wouldn't it? So feeling annoyed is just feeling annoyed. Taking that annoyance, believing in it, creating self and other, it puts me on the rim. But also feeling that annoyance and then hating myself for it is the same kind of violence. It's still the same problem. To know fear is fear. To know annoyance is annoyance. To know love is love. To know joy is joy. That's simply these kind of movements. And the hub and the center still point the intersection of timeless with time, the vertical rather than the horizontal, axis mundi. There's different kind of language that religious life uses. The spinal column, the tree, these different ways that we talk about, is this knowing, is this presence, which is always here and now. It couldn't be anywhere else, because there's only the here and now. There's only this present moment, there's only this knowing. So when you awaken, you know, when your mind is kind of reviewing the future, do it mindfully. Try to review the future mindfully. Or when you're reviewing thinking about the future, fine. Thinking about the past, fine. But when it goes into the habit of worry or resentment or whatever it might be, then awaken to that. Ah, this is a feeling of resentment, and there's the presence. Or this is a feeling of worry, and there's the presence. Now it's the knowing. And keep doing that, doing that, doing that, doing that. That's the training. Very simple training. Very simple training. It's very, very elegant. Yeah? It's not complicated. It's not thought. It's knowing. Awakening. Again and again and again. And you kind of just get really good at it. You get really good. And you find that the subtleties of delusion are seen more and more. So, oh gosh, I've been following that one for 50 years. I just noticed that. That's very surprising sometimes. Very amazing. And it does get very interesting, actually. It's not just a kind of... It's not control. That's a lot of people think that awareness is control. But if you look at willpower, actually willpower is something on the rim. It's still on the rim. Me trying to be a nice guy, or me trying to meditate. It's still this kind of willful trying to control. That's where people really lose it, I think, in meditation, because they just try to control the mind out of goodness. But they kind of they just give up. You know, you just kind of wonder, I can't do this anymore. Pass the beer. This is too difficult. That's because there's a kind of replacement therapy. You need to try to replace the bad guys with the good guys. You know, affirmations. Let's do our. Right? It can work a little bit. It can work a little bit, but you kind of, if you're always trying to control it, you're never really free. Whereas in the freedom of knowing annoyance as annoyance, and the trust, and the trust, and the trust of just being present to the feeling of annoyance, it does cease. It does end, and it's not you. And in that you begin to experience the real cessation of the delusion of self. You know, and the heart has this kind of peace which is not just from control and manipulation, not just from that. You can't keep that going. So the process of awakening is really not a matter of willfulness, it's a matter of openness. That's what it is, isn't it? It's not like kind of willfully controlling yourself to be awake, you're just awake. It's this way now. Awakening, awakening. At least that's the way I see it. So I'll leave that for tonight.
Sadhu.